Freeman on Tape, January 1990 edition. The Freeman on Tape is a monthly audio cassette edition of The Freeman, Ideas on Liberty, published by the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington on Hudson, New York, 10533. Contents of the January 1990 edition of The Freeman on Tape include Alaska's Other Oil Spill by Stephen L. Jackstadt and Dwight R. Lee. Perspective, Statements from Poland. And a fee classic, Not Yours to Give, from the life of Colonel David Crockett. Alaska's Other Oil Spill by Stephen L. Jackstadt and Dwight R. Lee. Stephen L. Jackstadt is an associate professor of economics at the University of Alaska, Anchorage. Dwight R. Lee is the Ramsey Professor of Economics at the University of Georgia, Athens. The Exxon oil spill in the Prince William Sound of Alaska was a terrible waste. An area of enormous natural beauty was polluted. Large numbers of animals were killed, and hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent on the cleanup, not to mention the loss of 11 million gallons of petroleum. Media coverage of the spill as a major event is understandable. Yet, by far the greatest destruction of wealth associated with Alaskan oil has gone entirely unnoticed. As a direct result of the actions of the Alaskan state government, a significant portion of the net value of Alaska's petroleum reserves has been wasted, just as surely as if it were being deliberately spilled into Prince William Sound. This waste continues without attracting the slightest attention from the press. Interestingly, the explanation for governmental spillage of Alaska's oil wealth is closely tied to the explanation for the Exxon oil spill. That explanation comes from the perverse incentives resulting from the use of property that is commonly rather than privately owned. In the absence of well-defined private property rights to a valuable resource, no one has much incentive to exercise proper care and restraint in the use of that resource. Those who make careless and excessive use of a common property resource capture all the benefits from that use, with the costs deferred in time and diffused over the general public. Prince William Sound is a clear example of a common property resource. It is commonly owned by the entire American public, with no one individual having either the motivation to incur a cost to protect it from abuse or the legal right to charge others for its use. Therefore, the savings the oil companies realize from exercising insufficient care in shipping oil through the sound or being inadequately prepared to respond to an accident are captured completely by the oil companies. On the other hand, the environmental damage to the sound from an oil spill will be imposed on the general public, with the oil companies being less than fully responsible for this cost. The common property problem can also motivate wasteful oil company decisions at the northern end of the Alaskan pipeline. With several companies pumping from common petroleum pools on the North Slope, the temptation facing each is to pump as quickly as possible with little regard for the adverse effects of excessive pumping on the total petroleum that can be recovered. Each company captures all the gain from its excessive pumping, with the costs of reduced future recovery being spread over all the companies. The company that takes the long-run view by moderating its current pumping risks losing out to the excessive pumping of others. Fortunately, these common property problems are well recognized, and steps have been taken to reduce their wasteful consequences. Exxon is being required by the threat of legal action, government sanctions, and by the pressure of public opinion, to pay for much, even though not all, of the costs of its carelessness. The bearing of this cost will certainly serve as a strong incentive for Exxon and other oil companies to exercise more caution in the future. Also, the oil companies operating on the North Slope have largely solved the common property problem of excessive recovery rates by forming a consortium in which the ownership shares of the petroleum recovered from a pool are determined independently of the recovery rate, with one company making the decision on that rate. It is widely and correctly recognized that government action is required if common property problems are to be adequately overcome. Government plays an important role by enforcing private property right arrangements when they emerge, as in the case of the North Slope oil fields, and by imposing sensible restrictions on the use and penalties on the abuse of resources when private ownership is impractical, as in the case with Prince William Sound. But what has not been widely recognized is that government is often the major source of common property problems, and as a consequence, the greatest threat to the value of our natural resources. A significant portion of the value of natural resources goes to government in the form of royalty and severance taxes. The burden of these taxes affects how much of a resource can be recovered profitably, and the use of the tax revenue affects the value derived from the resource. And both the tax burden and the use of the tax revenue are determined in a common property setting, every bit as destructive of resource wealth as any other uncontrolled common property setting. The ownership of government revenue is not determined by well-defined property rights. Instead, it is a common property resource which is allocated on the basis of political competition among various interest groups. This competition favors relatively small groups, actively organized around a narrowly focused interest, which is or can be served by some government program. Each of these interest groups is in a position completely analogous to that of an individual exploiting a common property resource. The interest group that manages to pump more out of the public treasury secures all of the benefits, but pays only a minuscule portion of the costs. The incentive for an interest group to moderate its demands on the public treasury for the long-run good of all is lacking completely. Such moderation will not be rewarded with reciprocal moderation on the part of other interest groups and will be seen as a useless sacrifice. The result is a wasteful special interest race for more government spending now with little thought given to its long-run consequences. Typically, special interest waste in government spending is moderated somewhat by the resistance of the taxpaying public. The somewhat has to be emphasized here, since taxpayers consist of such a large and diverse group of individuals, with no one taxpayer likely to be heavily burdened by the costs of any particular government program. For this reason, it is difficult to mobilize taxpayers in order to resist any given program, no matter how wasteful it may be. But taxpayers are aware of their tax burdens, and without explicitly organizing, can send politicians a clear message at the polls that there are limits to the tax burdens that will be tolerated. In Alaska, however, taxpayers have little motivation to resist the transfer of private wealth into common property state revenue. Since the discovery of oil on Alaska's North Slope in the late 1960s, well over 80% of the state's tax revenue has come from taxes on oil. These taxes are paid almost entirely by consumers and investors who do not live in Alaska. Not surprisingly, fiscal restraint is an alien concept to Alaskan politicians. When faced with constituent pressures to increase spending, politicians in Juneau have seen little reason to resist. Why risk aggravating those who can vote you out of office when they can be accommodated by increasing the taxes of those who cannot? Since 1968, the Alaskan legislature has increased taxes on oil 12 times. even though Alaska had by far the highest taxes in the nation on oil production, the 1989 state legislature increased the state taxes on Prudhoe Bay production by 25% and by about 60% on production out of the nearby Kuparuk oil field. The Alaskan state government is capturing over 50% of the net return generated by the recovery of North Slope oil, which is 70% more than the share received by the oil industry. These oil revenues are fueling state spending at unprecedented rates. Alaska is far out in front of the rest of the nation in per capita state spending. In 1986, per capita state spending in Alaska was $7,309, 2.5 times that of its nearest rival, Wyoming, and nearly 5 times the national average. The higher cost of living in Alaska can account for only a relatively small share of these differences. The wealth contained in North Slope oil has been treated as a vast common property resource by Alaska's politicians and their special interest clients. Predictably, the motivation has been to grab as much as possible with little worry about waste or regard for the future. The politicians and special interests are surely aware that the oil fields are a depleting resource and that current rates of state spending cannot long be continued. They must be aware that the long-run advantage of oil would be served by reducing spending today, so more could be saved to finance the continuation of reasonable spending levels in the future. Indeed, if state spending had been kept at a reasonable level over the last 20 years, that level could by now be maintained indefinitely from the interest on what would have been saved. But each special interest also knows, as does every exploiter of a common property resource, that the money it does not capture today for its spending program will instead be captured and immediately spent by another special interest. There is no way the Alaskan state government can spend the tremendous oil revenues on programs that make sense economically. But given the huge common property pool of oil revenues at their disposal, the politicians in Juneau are well aware that spending vast amounts on wasteful programs makes sense politically. Not surprisingly, the state of Alaska is literally spilling oil wealth throughout the state on one economic black hole after another. Consider some examples. In 1978, the state initiated a program to promote barley farming in Alaska. Over $50 million has been spent by the state on the project, providing farmers with loans that were not repaid, building access roads to the anticipated barley fields, purchasing railroad hopper cars to transport the barley, and constructing grain elevators to store the anticipated barley production, most of which was never grown. While taking money from the state government for the purpose of growing barley, Alaskan farmers were at the same time taking money from the federal government in return for not growing barley. The state spent $5.8 million on a barley processing terminal in the town of Seward before halting construction. If the terminal had been completed at a projected cost of $8.2 million, it could have processed all the barley grown in Alaska during its peak production year in 4.5 hours. While public school students in other states are taking an occasional field trip to a nearby attraction, many Alaskan students are flying off to Europe at public expense. The Bering Strait School District, for example, received a $300,000 grant from the Alaskan Department of Education in 1980 under a program that sponsors what are known as adventure-based education projects. This grant was used to provide students with a European tour. While the $88,414 travel cost for the trip was expensive, it was less than the $106,034 spent on consultant fees paid to the adventure-based educational specialists who arranged the trip and accompanied the students to Europe. The Alaskan state government has become an active supplier of below-cost and poorly collected loans. The Alaska Renewable Resources Corporation, ARRC, played a minor but interesting role in this loan activity. Established in 1978, the stated purpose of ARRC was to provide venture capital to those who attempted to utilize Alaska's renewable resources to develop such businesses as timber harvesting, seafood, fur farming, and wild berry candy. Being reluctant to discriminate against proposals just because they may be considered a bit bizarre, the ARRC has made loans for such purposes as developing dog-powered washing machines. It should come as no surprise that as of 1985, ARRC had written off $13 million in bad loans and investments, and a report by the legislative auditor classified another $16 million in loans as of doubtful collection. Unfortunately, ARRC loans make up only a small percentage of subsidized loans the state of Alaska uses in its effort to promote economic development. The success of Alaska's overall loan program offers little encouragement for those who see industrial planning by government as the best way to channel investment funds to emerging growth industries. As of the end of 1987, over $233 million in loans made by the Alaskan state government were in default, and another $1 billion were delinquent. The state of Alaska has not been content to confine its industrial efforts merely to making loans. The state acquired a meat plant for $3.5 million in the mid-1980s. And it has been losing money ever since. A state-owned dairy is another financial black hole. Despite the fact that the Anchorage School District is required to purchase milk from the state dairy at a price which is 7% above the prevailing market price, a markup which costs the school district approximately $25,000 per year, the dairy is persistently in the red. It lost $887,000 in 1987 alone. Performing arts centers, sports arenas, and convention centers built in towns and cities throughout the state do little more than stand as monuments to government extravagance and waste. An example is the $70 million Performing Arts Center constructed with state money in Anchorage. Independent auditors say that under the rosiest of revenue projections, the center will lose over $1 million annually. This projection considers only operating costs, ignoring completely the capital cost of the facility. There are an almost inexhaustible number of examples that could be given of wasteful spending by the Alaskan state government. The above examples, along with the figures presented earlier on per capita state spending, are compelling evidence that the state of Alaska distinguishes itself in terms of the sheer magnitude of governmentally induced waste. When it comes to wasteful government spending, no other state in the United States can challenge Alaska. The explanation for Alaska's wastefulness is not to be found in the venality of Alaskan politicians and officials any more than the oil spill in Prince William Sound can be blamed on the corruption of oil industry executives. In both cases, the outcomes are the result of people responding in predictable ways to the incentives that exist in the presence of common property resources. If there is a difference between the consequences of decisions on the transportation of petroleum by oil industry executives and decisions on the use of petroleum wealth by Alaskan politicians, it comes from the fact that the former are far more subject to the constraints of public opinion than are the latter. Almost everyone is aware of the waste resulting from the Exxon oil spill, as they will be of the waste from any future spill. And this public awareness serves as a powerful incentive for the oil industry to make careful use of our oceans and waterways. Almost no one is aware of the far greater waste resulting from the political exploitation of Alaska's oil wealth. And because this Alaskan oil spill is going unnoticed by the media, and therefore by the public, the politicians responsible for it continue their improvident ways with impunity. End of Alaska's Other Oil Spill by Stephen L. Jackstadt and Dwight R. Lee. Statements from Poland, a perspective, adapted from the January 1990 issue of the Freeman. East Germany, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania. Each day seems to bring news from a different Eastern European country. News of protests, reform, restructuring of existing governments, different faces in the top offices. We find ourselves wondering if there is a chance for true freedom in Eastern Europe. We are cheered that there are some active proponents of the freedom philosophy at work in these countries. We recently received the following statement of principles from three members of the Union for Real Politik in Breslau, Poland. We have made a few editorial changes for the sake of clarity. The Union for Real Politik is a political group whose main goal is to introduce the free market economy to Poland. We believe that state property should be transferred to the private sector by stock sale. Governmental and parliamentary interference in the economy should be forbidden and secured by the Constitution. All governmental subsidies, allocations, etc., should be repealed. The socialist welfare state, which already has failed, should be liquidated. Our ideal is an independent man, not a social welfare recipient. Leftist demagogues, social reformers, planners, and enlightened progressives should be fought ideologically and politically. Trade union activity should be allowed only under the condition that such laws as the inviolability of private ownership, freedom of work, and the prohibition against violence are respected. Taxes should be as low as possible and not progressive. The future educational system should be based on private schools. Compulsory school attendance and legally forced coeducation should be repealed. People should be free to found schools of all kinds, with different curricula and freely chosen languages of instruction. A strong, modernized, and technically well-equipped army, with additional military training for men in the Swiss fashion, is a necessity in Poland's geopolitical condition. It will be the best safeguard for our independence, not peace demonstrations or friendly statements made by other countries. Liberty is the basis for economic development, as well as for diversity of social, cultural, and intellectual life. The three Poles also included a statement on the idea of a united Europe. Again, we have made a few editorial changes. We categorically reject the idea of a united Europe. We are for a free Europe. That means a Europe where each country maintains its sovereignty. But all the impediments that hamper the free exchange of people, goods, and capital, entry visas, tariff walls, restricted freedom of settling, are repealed. We believe that the ideas being born in Brussels, headquarters of the European Community, and Strasbourg, seat of the Council of Europe, are dangerous for freedom and the peaceful development of Europe. in our opinion, these ideas will lead to the leveling and bureaucratization of Europe. In this way, efforts are being made to restrain the freedom movement in Europe and to spread centralism on an international scale. The idea of a united Europe will help Eurocrats, bureaucrats, lobbies, and politicians to keep and strengthen their power. Aiming to establish a common European government as well as armed forces is utopian and dangerous. What Europe needs is a free market economy based on private property and free competition, total freedom of trade, and the end to state intervention and planning. It is also essential that the welfare state be gradually liquidated. Each man should have the right of settling, living, and working wherever he can and wishes. Some people fear that this country will be overpopulated and impoverished unless we close our borders. But nothing could be more untrue. Where the rights of mankind are denied, where people are chattel, where the politically powerful eat out the substance of the powerless, those places have population explosions, famines, and disease. Where people are relatively free, left to their own devices, those places have stable populations, good health, and increasing wealth. The quality of life rises and falls in proportion to liberty. People seeking freedom are achievers, not burdens. Perspective, rent control, from an editorial in the May 30th, 1989, New York Times. After 46 years, rent control in New York City seems the normal state of affairs. Yet, it's a stifling state of affairs. In the early 1920s, after World War I, rent controls were allowed to expire. Apartment house construction boomed, then flickered in the early 1930s in New York, and revived as the economy improved before Pearl Harbor. If there were a continuing development of new apartment houses now, more people could move up, opening apartments for families in income groups below them. Never having seen a free housing market, today's tenants fear that without controls, they will be subject to gouging and capricious eviction. They do not understand that rent control has benefited the lucky, not the needy. As the prospect for profitable ownership of apartment houses improves, the supply increases. Competition for tenants among owners controls rents more effectively than governmental regulation. End of Side One, The Freeman on Tape, January 1990 edition. To continue, please turn the cassette over. Not Yours to Give, a Fee classic. Not Yours to Give was adapted from a chapter in the life of Colonel David Crockett, compiled by Edward S. Ellis and published in Philadelphia in 1884. The story of Davy Crockett and Horatio Bunce was first published in the Freeman in 1961. Since then, Fee has sold thousands of Not Yours to Give reprints, and the article has appeared many times in the Congressional Record. The saga of Davy Crockett, frontiersman, hunter, and brave defender of the Alamo is a familiar one. Less well known are his excursions into politics, first as a Tennessee state legislator, and later as a member of the House of Representatives. By all accounts, Davy Crockett was a shrewd, witty, and fiercely independent congressman. Perhaps predictably, he became discouraged and disgusted with politics, and left his native Tennessee for Texas, which was engaged in its struggle for independence. He lost his life at the Alamo on March 6, 1836. Here now is Davy Crockett's enduring statement on the morality of congressional appropriations. Not Yours to Give. One day, in the House of Representatives, a bill was taken up appropriating money for the benefit of a widow of a distinguished naval officer. Several beautiful speeches had been made in its support. The speaker was just about to put the question when Crockett arose. Mr. Speaker, I have as much respect for the memory of the deceased and as much sympathy for the sufferings of the living, if suffering there be, as any man in this House. But we must not permit our respect for the dead or our sympathy for a part of the living to lead us into an act of injustice to the balance of the living. I will not go into an argument to prove that Congress has no power to appropriate this money as an act of charity. Every member upon this floor knows it. We have the right, as individuals, to give away as much of our own money as we please in charity. But as members of Congress, we have no right so to appropriate a dollar of the public money. Some eloquent appeals have been made to us upon the ground that it is a debt due the deceased. Mr. Speaker, the deceased lived long after the close of the war. He was in office to the day of his death, and I have never heard that the government was in arrears to him. Every man in this House knows it is not a debt. We cannot, without the grossest corruption, appropriate this money as the payment of a debt. We have not the semblance of authority to appropriate it as a charity. Mr. Speaker, I have said we have the right to give as much money of our own as we please. I am the poorest man on this floor. I cannot vote for this bill, but I will give 1 week's pay to the object. And if every member of Congress will do the same, it will amount to more than the bill asks. He took his seat. Nobody replied. The bill was put upon its passage, and instead of passing unanimously, as was generally supposed, and as no doubt it would but for that speech, it received but few votes and, of course, was lost. Later, when asked by a friend why he had opposed the appropriation, Crockett gave this explanation. Several years ago, I was one evening standing on the steps of the Capitol with some other members of Congress when our attention was attracted by a great light over in Georgetown. It was evidently a large fire. We jumped into a hack and drove over as fast as we could. In spite of all that could be done, Many houses were burned, and many families made houseless. And besides, some of them had lost all but the clothes they had on. The weather was very cold. When I saw so many women and children suffering, I felt that something ought to be done for them. The next morning, a bill was introduced appropriating $20,000 for their relief. We put aside all other business and rushed it through as soon as it could be done. The next summer, when it began to be time to think about the election, I concluded I would take a scout around among the boys of my district. I had no opposition there, but as the election was some time off, I did not know what might turn up. When riding one day in a part of my district in which I was more of a stranger than any other, I saw a man in a field, plowing, and coming toward the road. I gauged my gait so that we should meet as he came up to the fence. As he came up, I spoke to the man. He replied politely, but, as I thought, rather coldly. I began, "Well, friend, I am one of those unfortunate beings called candidates. And, yes, I know you. You are Colonel Crockett. I have seen you once before and voted for you the last time you were elected. I suppose you are out electioneering now. But you had better not waste your time or mine. I shall not vote for you again." This was a sockdolager. I begged him to tell me what was the matter. "Well, Colonel, it is hardly worthwhile to waste time or words upon it. I do not see how it can be mended. But you gave a vote last winter, which shows that either you have not capacity to understand the Constitution, or that you are wanting in the honesty and firmness to be guided by it. In either case, you are not the man to represent me. But I beg your pardon for expressing it in that way. I did not intend to avail myself of the privilege of the constituent to speak plainly to a candidate for the purpose of insulting or wounding you. I intend by it only to say that your understanding of the Constitution is very different from mine. And I will say to you what, but for my rudeness, I should not have said, that I believe you to be honest, but an understanding of the Constitution different from mine I cannot overlook. Because the Constitution, to be worth anything, must be held sacred and rigidly observed in all its provisions. The man who wields power and misinterprets it is the more dangerous, the more honest he is." "I admit the truth of all you say, but there must be some mistake about it, for I do not remember that I gave any vote last winter upon any constitutional question." "No, Colonel, there's no mistake. Though I live here in the backwoods and seldom go from home, I take the papers from Washington and read very carefully all the proceedings of Congress. My papers say that last winter you voted for a bill to appropriate $20,000 to some sufferers by a fire in Georgetown. Is that true?" "Well, my friend, I may as well own up. You've got me there. But certainly nobody will complain that a great and rich country like ours should give the insignificant sum of $20,000 to relieve its suffering women and children, particularly with a full and overflowing treasury. And I am sure if you had been there, you would have done just as I did." "It is not the amount, Colonel, that I complain of. It is the principle. In the first place, the government ought to have in the treasury no more than enough for its legitimate purposes. But that has nothing to do with the question. The power of collecting and dispersing money at pleasure is the most dangerous power that can be entrusted to man, particularly under our system of collecting revenue by a tariff, which reaches every man in the country, no matter how poor he may be. And the poorer he is, the more he pays in proportion to his means. What is worse, it presses upon him without his knowledge where the weight centers, for there is not a man in the United States who can ever guess how much he pays to the government. So you see that while you are contributing to relieve one, you are drawing it from thousands who are even worse off than he. If you had the right to give anything, the amount was simply a matter of discretion with you, and you had as much right to give $20 million as $20,000. If you have the right to give to one, you have the right to give to all. And as the Constitution neither defines charity nor stipulates the amount, you are at liberty to give to any and everything which you may believe or profess to believe is a charity, and to any amount you may think proper. You will very easily perceive what a wide door this would open for fraud and corruption and favoritism on the one hand, and for robbing the people on the other. No, Colonel. Congress has no right to give charity. Individual members may give as much of their own money as they please, but they have no right to touch a dollar of the public money for that purpose. If twice as many houses had been burned in this county as in Georgetown, neither you nor any other member of Congress would have thought of appropriating a dollar for our relief. There are about 240 members of Congress. If they had shown their sympathy for the sufferers by contributing each 1 week's pay, it would have made over $13,000. There are plenty of wealthy men in and around Washington who could have given $20,000 without depriving themselves of even a luxury of life. The congressmen chose to keep their own money, which, if reports be true, some of them spend not very creditably. And the people about Washington, no doubt, applauded you for relieving them from the necessity of giving by giving what was not yours to give. The people have delegated to Congress by the Constitution the power to do certain things. To do these, it is authorized to collect and pay monies, and for nothing else. Everything beyond this is usurpation and a violation of the Constitution. So you see, Colonel, you have violated the Constitution in what I consider a vital point. It is a precedent fraught with danger to the country. For when Congress once begins to stretch its power beyond the limits of the Constitution, there is no limit to it, and no security for the people. I have no doubt you acted honestly, but that does not make it any better, except as far as you are personally concerned. And you see that I cannot vote for you. I tell you, I felt streaked. I saw if I should have opposition, and this man should go to talking, he would set others to talking. And in that district, I was a gone fawn skin. I could not answer him, and the fact is, I was so fully convinced that he was right, I did not want to. But I must satisfy him, and I said to him, "Well, my friend, you hit the nail upon the head when you said I had not sense enough to understand the Constitution. I intended to be guided by it, and thought I had studied it fully. I have heard many speeches in Congress about the powers of Congress, but what you have said here at your plow has got more hard, sound sense in it than all the fine speeches I ever heard. If I had ever taken the view of it that you have, I would have put my head into the fire before I would have given that vote. And if you will forgive me and vote for me again, if I ever vote for another unconstitutional law, I wish I may be shot." He laughingly replied, "Yes, Colonel, you have sworn to that once before. But I will trust you again upon one condition. You say that you were convinced that your vote was wrong. Your acknowledgement of it will do more good than beating you for it. If, as you go around the district, you will tell people about this vote, that you are satisfied it was wrong, I will not only vote for you, but will do what I can to keep down opposition. And perhaps I may exert some little influence in that way. If I don't, said I wish I may be shot. And to convince you that I am in earnest in what I say, I will come back this way in a week or 10 days, and if you will get up a gathering of the people, I will make a speech to them. Get up a barbecue, and I will pay for it. No, Colonel. We are not rich people in this section, but we have plenty of provisions to contribute for a barbecue, and some to spare for those who have none. The push of crops will be over in a few days, and we can then afford a day for a barbecue. This is Thursday. I will see to getting it up on Saturday week. Come to my house on Friday, and we will go together, and I promise you a very respectable crowd to see and hear you. Well, I will be here. But one thing more before I say goodbye. I must know your name. My name is Bunce. Not Horatio Bunce. Yes. Well, Mr. Bunce, I never saw you before, though you say you have seen me, but I know you very well. I am glad I have met you, and very proud that I may hope to have you for my friend. It was one of the luckiest hits of my life that I met him. He mingled but little with the public, but was widely known for his remarkable intelligence and incorruptible integrity, and for a heart brimful and running over with kindness and benevolence, which showed themselves not only in words, but in acts. He was the oracle of the whole country around him, and his fame had extended far beyond the circle of his immediate acquaintance. Though I had never met him before, I had heard much of him. And, but for this meeting, it is very likely I should have had opposition and had been beaten. One thing is very certain. No man could now stand up in that district under such a vote. At the appointed time, I was at his house, having told our conversation to every crowd I had met, and to every man I stayed all night with. And I found that it gave the people an interest and a confidence in me stronger than I had ever seen manifested before. Though I was considerably fatigued when I reached his house, and under ordinary circumstances should have gone early to bed, I kept him up until midnight, talking about the principles and affairs of government, and got more real, true knowledge of them than I had got all my life before. I have known and seen much of him since, for I respect him. No, that is not the word. I reverence and love him more than any living man, and I go to see him 2 or 3 times every year. And I will tell you, sir, if everyone who professes to be a Christian lived and acted and enjoyed it as he does, the religion of Christ would take the world by storm. But to return to my story. The next morning we went to the barbecue. To my surprise, found about 1,000 men there. I met a good many whom I had not known before. They and my friend introduced me around until I had got pretty well acquainted. At least, they all knew me. In due time, notice was given that I would speak to them. They gathered up around a stand that had been erected. I opened my speech by saying, "Fellow citizens, I present myself before you today feeling like a new man. My eyes have lately been opened to truths which ignorance, or prejudice, or both, had heretofore hidden from my view. I feel that I can today offer you the ability to render you more valuable service than I have ever been able to render before. I am here today more for the purpose of acknowledging my error than to seek your votes. That I should make this acknowledgement is due to myself as well as to you. Whether you will vote for me is a matter for your consideration only. I went on to tell them about the fire and my vote for the appropriation, and then told them why I was satisfied it was wrong. I closed by saying, "And now, fellow citizens, it remains only for me to tell you that the most of the speech you have listened to with so much interest was simply a repetition of the arguments by which your neighbor, Mr. Bunce, convinced me of my error. It is the best speech I ever made in my life, but he is entitled to the credit for it. And now I hope he is satisfied with his convert, and that he will get up here and tell you so." He came up to the stand and said, "Fellow citizens, it affords me great pleasure to comply with the request of Colonel Crockett. I have always considered him a thoroughly honest man, and I am satisfied that he will faithfully perform all that he has promised you today." He went down, and there went up from that crowd such a shout for Davy Crockett as his name never called forth before. I am not much given to tears, but I was taken with a choking then and felt some big drops rolling down my cheeks. And I tell you now that the remembrance of those few words spoken by such a man and the honest, hearty shout they produced is worth more to me than all the honors I have received and all the reputation I have ever made or shall ever make as a member of Congress. Now, sir, concluded Crockett, you know why I made that speech yesterday. There is one thing now to which I will call your attention. You remember that I propose to give a week's pay. There are in that house many very wealthy men, men who think nothing of spending a week's pay or a dozen of them for a dinner or a wine party when they have something to accomplish by it. Some of those same men made beautiful speeches upon the great debt of gratitude which the country owed the deceased, a debt which could not be paid by money, and the insignificance and worthlessness of money, particularly so insignificant a sum as $20,000, when weighed against the honor of the nation. Yet not one of them responded to my proposition. Money with them is nothing but trash when it is to come out of the people. But it is the one great thing for which most of them are striving, and many of them sacrifice honor, integrity, and justice to obtain it. We hope you have enjoyed the January 1990 edition of The Freeman on Tape. The Freeman on Tape is a monthly audio cassette edition of The Freeman, Ideas on Liberty, published by the Foundation for Economic Education. For information about subscribing to The Freeman on Tape, write the Foundation for Economic Education, 30 South Broadway, Irvington on Hudson, New York, 10533, or call area code 914-591-7230.